This is actually an important lecture today. I think the conclusions that we're going to reach by the end of the lecture are going to strike you as a little shocking, because they are so much at odds with what you've been led to believe about how the United States entered the Second World War. The analysis today is also very important from the point of view of international relations theory. You see, there's something very puzzling about the Second World War, American involvement in the Second World War, both in Europe and in Asia. Here you have Hitler, you know, with his hands full with this massive undertaking, this war against the Soviet Union, with the goal of just destroying Soviet power, conquering Soviet Russia, imposing the Nazi New Order on the conquered areas. Yeah? Okay, I'll turn it up, but hopefully it won't echo too much. Okay? Is that better? Okay. Why would he, 4 days after Pearl Harbor, December 11th, 1941, declare war on the United States, by the strongest country in the world in terms of its mobilizable war potential? By far. You know, a lot of historians, they say, you know, it can't be understood in rational terms. Taylor himself, you know, who takes as we saw, kind of a very hardcore power political approach to understanding international politics, concludes his book by saying Hitler gratuitously attacked the United States. In other words, it doesn't make sense in power political terms. Right? Similarly, in the case of Japan. Japan has her hands full with this war in China that began in 1937, the so-called China Incident, undeclared war. Japan can't find China. Japan's bogged, can't defeat China. Japan is bogged down in this war. And with her hands full with China, she's going to gratuitously bring on war with the United States, again, by far the strongest country in the world, vastly stronger than Japan, right? You see how this relates to the kind of core issues that dominate the whole field of international relations scholarship? The whole issue of realism, the whole issue of, you know, the assumption that political behavior is essentially rational and is shaped to a very large extent by power political considerations. Countries don't behave in crazy ways. They don't behave in these irrational ways. Right? Their behavior makes sense given their interest defined in power political terms. And yet you have these two countries behaving in seemingly irrational ways. Right? If that view is correct, you know, it's like, well, how do you explain America's involvement in a war? Well, you know, they were attacked by Japan because Japan was governed by these war-crazed lunatics, right? And then Germany joined in the fray because Hitler was also a war-crazed monster. And it's like, you know, can it be? If that view is correct, well, that would have a profound bearing on how we understand international politics. On the other hand, if it turns out that it's incorrect, if the behavior of both Japan and Germany is not nearly as irrational as we've been led to believe, if the behavior of the United States, on the other hand, was much more active and much more shaped by power political considerations and played a very, very important role in bringing on the war with both Germany and Japan, well, then that would be powerful evidence in support of the realist understanding of international politics, precisely because it's so much at variance with the conventional wisdom in this area, because those results would be so surprising, right? It's for that reason that it makes sense to study the whole process that led to American intervention in the Second World War, which, you know, had a decisive impact on the whole course of international politics for the whole post-1941 period, up to and including today, right? It's for that reason that a very close analysis of this whole story that led to American intervention in the war is very much worth undertaking, all right? So let me just say before I begin that the discussion today is going to be a little complex and analytical and not perhaps as fleshed out with historical detail as you might like, but if you want to follow the argument on the course website, in the recommended or optional readings for this week, I put this thing that I wrote about this whole business. I posted it online. This is a chapter from a book I wrote on historical method and how a historical method could be brought to bear on the study of international relations. And I wanted to show in that chapter how, you know, you would go about making up your own mind about some major historical issue. And my own field of scholarship was the Cold War, and I didn't want to do something where I had like a really kind of deep expertise. I wanted to do something else where I didn't know Japanese, or whatever, and I felt like there's a method that you can use to get to the bottom of this story, even with a certain limited amount of time and limited command of the evidence, not going to the archives or anything like that. So if you want to see the whole kind of thought process that led to the elaboration of the interpretation I'm going to present to you today, that's where you should look. And I have to say, I just find this whole story very, very interesting, very important, in large part because it goes against the conventional wisdom. Okay. So let me begin by reviewing where we were last time. As I say, there are these puzzles here. The whole puzzle of, does the Japanese decision to go to war with the United States make sense? Well, from the standpoint of realist theory, it's crazy. It's an anomaly. The same point about Germany. And that, incidentally, is why a theoretical perspective is so important. Not because it gives you answers, but because it brings the questions into focus and helps you zero in on what's important. You know, it's like the puzzle there. That's like, how should I put it? It's like a loose thread in the whole fabric of received interpretation of the views that you've been led to hold. And then you start pulling on that loose thread, and the whole fabric begins to unravel. And you see the world, not just the whole story of the coming of the. Of World War II and American intervention in World War II, but the larger issue of how international politics works, you see those issues in an entirely different light when you do this. Right? That's okay. So I said I wanted to kind of begin by reviewing the lecture last time. I should say that I needed the projector for this map. This is a map that was published in the New York Times in the middle of 1941. So it gives you a sense for how the issue of East Asia was viewed at the time, and it kind of gives you the basics. So I needed the projector for the map, and so I put the outline on the blackboard here, but I also have another version of it that I posted in the outline section of the course website, so if you need that. Okay, so let me quickly review the point of the lecture last time. What was America's role in international politics from September 1939 on? And the United States didn't want a German victory in the initial part of the war, but felt it didn't have to intervene because Britain and France, by themselves, were strong enough to defend themselves against Germany. Not necessarily strong enough to defeat Germany, but as long as their power remained intact, there would be limits to what the Germans could do. There would be Germany would not become a European hegemon and thus in a position to command these massive economic resources of the continent of Europe and mobilize those resources and build such a powerful military machine that the Germans could threaten the United States. Okay? We didn't have to worry about that. We only began to really worry seriously after the fall of France in June of 1940. Now Hitler was the master in the continent of Europe. Now the only obstacle between him and total domination, at least of Western Europe, was the fact that the British were holding on. But without British support, without American support, how long could the British hold out? And so the whole notion was, we had to support the British. Fundamental decision that Roosevelt made after the fall of France. Right? And it was because of the changed geostrategic situation resulting from the fall of France, the consequent threat to American security. Great buildup of American military power decided on this in this period. But you're going from zero, you know, so it takes a long time to build up a massive military establishment. But, you know, there's clearly a threat to American security. The Americans want to be prepared. It means sustaining the British. The policy is sold to the American people with the argument that this would be an alternative to American intervention. As long as the British could hold out, you know, we would not have to worry so much about the German threat. We had a vital interest in the maintenance of British independence, right? But by late 1940, American leaders had come to the conclusion that this policy was simply not good enough in the long run. That sooner or later, we were going to have to intervene in the war in a more direct way. In other words, our soldiers were going to have to fight, our soldiers and our sailors. Why? Because there would be no chance that Britain could defeat Germany without an active American intervention of that sort. And when the British came to see that they would, if they ever came to see that the Americans were never going to intervene, then they would have an enormous incentive to come to terms with the Germans. And that would mean that German hegemony in Europe would be recognized with all the implications that it had about the long-term threat to American security. Okay? So American strategic thought in late 1940, even before the election, began to shift. The key document there was something called the Plan Dog Memorandum written by Admiral Howard Stark. Yes?
Do you mean 1930?
No, 1940. 1940.
Okay.
1940. It's like the whole point is that the dramatic changes taking place in Europe caused dramatic changes in American strategic thought, right? The fall of France, you know, leads to this, a quickening of the pace of American involvement. We can't just sit on our hands. We have to be a whole lot more active. And as I say, this key document, the Plan Dog Memorandum, late 1940, basically said that we're going to have to intervene with our troops. We're going to have to actually do some fighting. We can't expect the British to carry the entire burden by themselves. The British can hold out for a certain period of time if, at the end of the road, you know, they have some clear sense that the Americans are going to come to their aid in a material way, you know, sending troops. Okay, but Roosevelt agrees with all this stuff. But he can't be open and public about it for the time being. Why? Because, you know, here he is running for an unprecedented third term. The Republicans sense that there's a lot of political mileage to be gained out of attacking Roosevelt for pursuing a policy that's going to bring the United States into war. And so in order to kind of limit the political damage, Roosevelt takes a what come across as an isolationist line. You know, I will not send your troops to die in, you know, foreign battles and so on. And I pointed out, very common in American history, Woodrow Wilson was reelected on the slogan, he kept us out of war in 1916, took us into the war just a few months later. Lyndon Johnson, same point, ran against Barry Goldwater in 1964. I won't send American troops to fight wars that Asian boys should be fighting, right? A few months later, after he wins the election, American troops are involved in Vietnam in a really major way. There's something about our political system that gives our political leaders an enormous incentive to take that line in public, whereas in reality their views are totally different, right? And you could get all upset. This is against our democratic norms. Our political leaders lie to us. How outrageous it is that they're not straight with their own population. They're forced into it by the very basic structure of the system. They themselves have to think in power political terms, but they're constrained by the need to pander to a public opinion that's unwilling to contemplate going to war for political reasons, as opposed to us being attacked, or the moral issues are clear cut. We only fight wars of necessity. We never fight wars of chance until this awful George W. Bush came to power in Washington. You know, you've heard all that stuff. It's but it's built into the structure of our system. You know, this is one of Kennan's basic complaints at the end of that article that you read in the first week. You know, it's like, well, this is what democracies are like, and I don't know. You know, let's try and figure out some way of dealing with it, but there's a basic problem with democratic foreign policy. You know, after the Cold War, the whole country was patting itself on the back. We won the Cold War because of our wonderful democratic system and so on. And, democracies are so much better than other countries, especially in the conduct of foreign policy and so. You've got to bear all these things in mind when you're evaluating that whole line of argument. Okay, so American policy, it changes after the fall of France, but there are limits on what Roosevelt could do in public. So he's forced to pursue his policies more stealthily. You know, after the election, he has a much freer hand. They get Lend-Lease, which is, you know, America's going to, support the British with its, by becoming the great arsenal of democracy, it was going to supply the British with the argument that, well, the British are going to do the fighting and all we're going to do is apply the materiel, and this is a way of keeping us out of the war rather than bringing us into the war. People doubted that that was the case, but packaging the policy in that way made it politically congenial and made it easier for Roosevelt to take yet another step on the road to bringing the United States into the war. Why? Because once you talk about America's the arsenal of democracy and having Lend-Lease and supplying the British with all these armaments and so on, you're led to the next step, which is we can't allow the Germans to destroy that supply channel by having their submarines sink the vessels bringing the British that Lend-Lease aid. So we're going to have to protect those supply convoys. And given the conditions of modern naval warfare, that means going on the offense and attacking German submarines preemptively and so on, and getting us involved in, at the very least, a naval war with the Germans in the North Atlantic. And in fact, as you all know, the United States, beginning in August of 1941, was fighting a major naval war against the Germans in the North Atlantic. It didn't lead to formal hostilities between America and Germany because Hitler held back his navy, and the American navy, for its part, was still too weak to pursue a really aggressive policy against these German naval vessels. But it's clear the thrust of Roosevelt's policy. Okay? The next big step, crucial in shaping the history of this period, was the German attack on the Soviet Union in June of 1941. Itself shaped in large measure by Hitler's sense that his window of opportunity was closing, that Roosevelt gradually was bringing the United States into the war, that there were constraints on how rapidly Roosevelt could move, mainly domestic political constraints. This gave Hitler a certain window of opportunity to clear the decks in the East before he had to face the United States. It was quite clear that these considerations about what this German historian Andreas Hillgruber called the America factor played a fundamental role in shaping Hitler's decision to attack the Soviet Union when he did. Right? And I should say that for those of you who are interested in this stuff, this is a really terrific book that came out a few years ago by a British historian named Adam Tooze, actually he's now at Yale, called Wages of Destruction, The Rise and Fall of the Nazi War Economy. You know, of all the things that have come out on the origins of the Second World War in the last 20 or 30 years, none of them have made anything like the impression on me and changed my whole thinking about the origins of the war nearly as much as this Adam Tooze book. You know, and in the Tooze book, you could see how important the America factor was in determining Nazi foreign policy. Tooze's argument is that, you know, Germany's not an economic superpower. Germany is a relatively poor country, and the limits on how much military power, the economic limits on how much military power Germany can create, are much tighter than we had been led to believe. And that tightness, those economic constraints, they had a fundamental role in shaping the course of Hitler invades the Soviet Union in June, and this in turn has a dramatic effect on American policy, because there's a great quickening of American policy. I mentioned before the decision to conduct the undeclared naval war with the goal of provoking Hitler into declaring war on the United States. Because it's much easier to bring the whole country into a war if it feels it's the innocent victim of unprovoked attack than to take the country into the war as a result of a political decision. Right? Why is it that Roosevelt now feels that we have to get into the war with Germany really fast? That he has to kind of push against the political constraints and do what's necessary to take the United States into the war against Germany, not just eventually in the distant future, 2 or 3 years down the road or something, but pretty much right away within the course of the next few months. Okay? The answer to that question is revealed by a very important document. This is called the Victory Program. And it's very easy to remember the date, because like I said last time, 60 years to the day before the attacks on New York and Washington. The connection is important because it relates to the whole notion of preventive war, what the Bush administration called preemptive war. Because the Victory Program, like the decision to respond to the September 11th attacks by a much more aggressive American policy, was rooted in preventive war thinking. We can't just sit on our hands. If we just sit on our hands and allow the Germans a free hand to do what they want against the Soviet Union, they'll be able to defeat Soviet Russia. And when Soviet Russia falls, and they expected Soviet Russia to fall, then there'll be chaos for a couple of years, but eventually the Germans will be able, in the words of the Victory Program, to bring order out of chaos in the occupied areas, organize all of Eurasia from the Atlantic Ocean straight through to the Ural Mountains under German control, and harness all of those resources to the Germans' war machine, and with internal lines of communication, that German superpower will be essentially unconquerable. And the long-term threat to the United States will be unmanageable. Now, the Victory Program was a document prepared by top officers in the American military, both the Army and the Navy. There being no Air Force in this period, as you know. And it was submitted to Roosevelt September 11, 1941. And the implication was not just that if we got involved in the war, we should fight the war this way as opposed to another, by concentrating on Germany first, but rather that we needed to pursue a policy that would land us in the war sooner rather than later. So it's like, we can't just wait for Hitler to decide to go to war on us. We have to take the initiative. A very hard policy to sell domestically. All right? And you see very clearly how that sort of thinking, the need for America to pursue a more aggressive policy, a policy that amounted to a preventive war policy, of not just waiting for the Germans to attack us, but taking the initiative and bringing the war to the Germans while we still had some chance of defeating Germany at a relatively bearable price. Right? You could see how that thinking developed as a direct result of the German decision to move in the Soviet Union. In other words, this created a sort of window for the United States, a window of opportunity which pushed the Americans forward. And the German decision to attack the Soviet Union was itself a product of the creation of a window for Germany, as Roosevelt clearly was moving toward more active American involvement in the war. We see this from the German documents. Why is all this important? It shows one of the ways in which political science thinking, international relations ideas, can play a powerful role in deepening historical understanding. In the political science literature, all the stuff about windows, preventive war, the political effects of real and perceived shifts in the military balance, both at the present and in the future, the argument runs, this plays a very important role in shaping international political life. Diplomatic historians like me in the old days, we just ignored all of this stuff. We kind of laughed at it. But then it turns out that the political scientists were onto something that we were just blind to. These window dynamics, preventive war dynamics, played a very major role in shaping the story. Actually, we saw that even in 1939, when the British felt that they couldn't keep up the pace of rearmament indefinitely. And this had a dramatic effect in terms of getting the British to shift from appeasement to resistance in 1939. Right? All this stuff is very important, because it shows that what's going on, you can make sense of it. It's not just war-crazed lunatics striking out in this totally irrational way. You know, it's like not necessarily that Hitler thought that by moving against the Soviet Union when he did, he would be able to solve all of his problems. But under the force of these sorts of political dynamics, the dynamic leading to American involvement in the war and so on, Hitler is gradually losing control over the course of events. And so when the war comes with the United States, as one of Hillgruber's main arguments, this is not a happy turn of events for Hitler. You know, he was overtaken by events. He was essentially, overwhelmed by a process that he to be sure had played a key role in instigating, but could no longer control. So you have this dramatic change in American policy that takes place in the second half of 1941. We saw it in the record of Roosevelt's meeting with Churchill at Argentia off the coast of Placentia Bay, off the coast of Newfoundland, near the town of Argentia. This is also called the Atlantic Conference, August 1941. But well known for the Atlantic Charter. It's like a statement of war aims, the famous Atlantic Charter. They say, why is the United States getting involved in laying down war aims when the Americans aren't even a belligerent at this point? Roosevelt tells Churchill what his policy is. He wants to provoke Hitler into going to war. Hitler, for his part, doesn't want to respond to the provocation, obviously, because he has his hands full with Russia. The admirals are very upset, but there's nothing they could do. All right. So this creates a problem for Roosevelt. You know, how can he get the United States into the war when Hitler is unwilling to respond to these American provocations, and the American people are unwilling to, you know, declare war on Germany for purely political reasons without themselves being attacked? And this is what raises the whole issue of the crisis with Japan. How was the crisis with Japan to be understood? Because we came into the war as a result of Pearl Harbor, as a result of the Japanese attack on the United States. Say, is this just a coincidence? Is this an entirely separate story? The story of the coming of the war in the Pacific? How, is it to be understood in Asia-specific terms, in terms of the Americans just being finally so fed up with what the Japanese were doing in China and saying, you know, we can't deal with that anymore. We're going to go to war with them. And so they lay on the embargo and so on, and this leads to the war. You know, is it isolated from the much more important European story? Because no one thought that Japan posed a long-term threat to America, but they did think that Germany did, right? So does it stand to reason that these East Asian developments could be totally isolated from the European story? Well, you know, again, all your instincts from studying international relations about the way it works, the kind of considerations that shape policy, so, you know, all that stuff suggests that, no, there must be a connection between the story of the origins of the U.S.-Japanese War, the War in the Pacific, as it's called, and the larger European story. In other words, this is what we call the backdoor to war thesis. The backdoor to war thesis is that Roosevelt deliberately put the United States on a collision course with Japan as a way of bringing the country into the European war. Right? The thesis is largely discredited in the eyes of historians because they conflate it with this conspiracy theory that you find on the right and on certain sections of the isolationist left, that Roosevelt knew that the Japanese were about to attack Pearl Harbor and kept that knowledge from the commanders in Hawaii because he wanted the Japanese to conduct a devastating attack there so that he could bring a united and vengeful country into the war as a whole. There is no evidence for that. That theory is nonsense and baseless. But the larger issue of whether Roosevelt pursued a policy vis-a-vis Japan aimed at bringing about a U.S.-Japanese war as a way of getting the United States into the European war, well, that deserves to be taken much more seriously. Okay. Okay. What is the story here? We're led to believe that Pearl Harbor came as a bolt from the blue. Right? Not true. War with Japan was expected. As I say, people didn't expect the attack to come in Hawaii. Some people did, but most people didn't. Most people thought that Japan would attack the Philippines. Why would the Japanese do that? A lot of it has to do with American policy. As I say, it wasn't a bolt from the blue. The Americans had pursued a policy that in effect, and we're going to consider next whether this was intentional, but in effect, put America and Japan on a collision course. What happened here? The Japanese had been encouraged by the fall of France and the fact that the French, and for that matter, Dutch possessions, were relatively undefended since both Holland and France were now essentially occupied by Germany, defeated by Germany. And from the Japanese point of view, their main goal was how to defeat Chinese resistance. China was getting support from the south, and you could threaten those supply lines by moving south into what was then French Indochina. And threatening the supply lines to Zhongjing, which is the Chinese nationalist capital that ran through Burma. Plus, by moving south, you could get control over sources of raw materials that were essential to the Japanese military effort in China. The closer you came to the Indies, which is an oil-producing area, the more leverage you would have over the policy pursued by the authorities there so that you get them to make sure that the flow of oil continued. Essential for Japan. So they moved south gradually, and then in July 1941, they moved into southern Indochina as a result of an agreement with the local authorities there who were, you know, under the control of the Vichy regime in France that was heavily influenced by the Nazis. So they moved, Japan moves peacefully, that is, into southern Indochina, French colony, at the end of July 1941, and the Americans respond by laying on an oil embargo. Now, it may surprise you to learn that Japan imported a lot of oil in those days from the United States, and in fact from California. And it, you know, if you're coming back from the airport, instead of taking the 405, if you come off La Cienega, you could still see some of those old oil wells pumping away. And so Japan was dependent on oil imports for her military effort, not for her larger economy, which is still a coal-based economy. And Japan had plenty of coal in Manchuria, which they had conquered in the early 1930s. But their military effort, including their naval effort, relied on liquid fuels. And it wasn't just that they were being deprived of getting oil from the United States, but also America's friends cooperated with the embargo, and friends being the British and the Dutch, and America, Britain, and Holland together, they control practically all the exportable oil in the world. So basically, Japan was going to be starved of oil. Now, what is the logic of the situation created by the oil embargo? And this is a very important point. You know, it's like it's extremely important that everyone should understand the logic of the situation created by the oil embargo and why the oil embargo put Japan on a collision course with the United States. Okay? What's the logic of this situation? Japan needs this oil. How's it gonna get the oil supplies to resume? They need the oil because without it, their military effort in China is going to grind to a halt, and their political position in China will therefore collapse. So they need to avoid capitulation over China. They need the oil flow of oil to resume. How can they do it? There are only two ways. A negotiation with the United States that results in a resumption of the flow of oil, or the seizure of the oil-producing areas in the Indies, which they're perfectly capable of doing. But what's the problem with these things? First, the whole question of a negotiation. It's the Americans who are totally intransigent. The Japanese are desperate to reach a negotiated settlement with the United States. Right? According to the American ambassador in Japan, Joseph Grew, they were willing to give away the store, to accept the American terms, quote, whatever they might be. And it's the Americans who are unwilling to accept even a face-saving settlement with Japan. This is quite extraordinary. Because the Japanese have no problem seeing what the outcome of a war would be. Right? But a total humiliating capitulation, you know, total withdrawal from China, not even anything of a face-saving nature for Japan. Well, that's very hard for any country to accept. And yet, that's what the American terms were, and the American government was under no illusions about what the consequence of that would be. Right? So Prince Konoya, the Japanese prime minister, he tells Grew pretty much, I will accept whatever terms your government offers. I just need to present my own government with a fait accompli. let's have a, and he proposes this meeting with Roosevelt on American soil in Alaska. It's the Americans who turn it down. And this leads to the fall of the Quinault government and its replacement by a government headed by the war minister, General Tojo. And even then, in late 1941, pressed forward by the Japanese foreign minister, Togo Shigenori, the Japanese proposed something called the modus vivendi, which the effect of this was to turn back the clock and create this, reestablish the situation that had existed prior to the Japanese movement to southern China. They were willing to actually withdraw from these areas that they had occupied. This whole notion that Japan was uncontainable and so on, it's contradicted by the whole modus vivendi plan. And a lot of people thought, well, this is the germs of an agreement. The agreement could be worked out on this basis. In exchange for that, oil supplies would resume at their pre-July level. Americans turn it down. You know, our Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, furious by the fact that it had turned down. Our whole military establishment, very upset by this, because they wanted us to go to the war with Germany. The last thing they want is to be distracted by the need to fight a second war with Japan, which, you know, it's clear that the United States would win, but this is totally unnecessary from their point of view. Okay? No negotiation in the cards. So you can't have a negotiated settlement. What about a military settlement? Military settlement with Japan seizing the Indies, but the Americans made it clear to the Japanese that this would result in war with the United States. Okay. And partly for military reasons, because in order to do it, they would have to worry about what the Americans could do from their bases in the Philippines to interdict those oil supplies and so on, so they felt that they had to attack the Philippines. But an attack on the Philippines would bring America into the war, so if you're going to fight a war, well, you may as well get the advantages of the first strike. Those kinds of considerations. Right? So Japan is in a box. Japan is in a corner. Basically, the choices for Japan are really stark. You know, except total defeat in China, either by acquiescing in the oil cutoff, or by reaching a political settlement which reflects that degree of capitulation, or go to war with the United States. And faced with that choice, that's the context in which they went to war, an act of desperation, right? And the everyone knows, all the scholars have studied this stuff, they say in terms of objective consequence, the oil embargo had the effect of putting the United States on a collision course with Japan for those reasons. But that's not the same as saying that that's what the Americans wanted to do. Objective consequence does not necessarily reflect subjective intent. And the claim was that the American government did not want war with Japan. So how do you explain? How do you square that particular circle? You know, they didn't want a war, but they pursued a policy that led to war. And you look at the historical literature, political science literature as well, and it turns out that there are two basic explanations. One explanation is the American government didn't know what it was doing. It took all these economic measures thinking that Japan was going to be deterred, and to its great surprise, the Japanese struck out and got involved with war with America. And the other view, and this is the view you find in the Heinrichs book, and you should read that Heinrichs book using that method that was outlined, especially in the lecture on Taylor. Which is that the Roosevelt administration, they didn't want war with Japan. Roosevelt, Hull, and the top officials in the U.S. government, their goal was not war, but they lost control over policymaking. Policymaking had been hijacked by low-level officials that didn't know what they were doing, arrogant second-tier officials like Assistant Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who presumptuously seized control over policy. All right. And then it occurs to you that those two explanations, they're the only explanations that you could have. Because if it were the case that the top political leadership understood what the effects of the embargo were, and if also they had total control over policy, then the policy of putting the United States on a collision course with Japan, the oil embargo policy, would have to be viewed as deliberate. So for it not to be deliberate, one or the other of those things has to not be true. Either they did not know what they were doing, or they had lost control over events. And so, you know, using that type of analysis, you can unpack the problem and then analyze those specific claims in the light of the historical evidence and reach a conclusion as to whether the policy was deliberate. Okay? The first thing, this whole business of ignorance. They didn't know what they were doing. It's just there's no basis for this. Roosevelt had opposed the embargo, including in public, a few days before it was imposed, with the argument that it would lead to a U.S.-Japanese war. He said this thing over and over again, both in public and in private, as a way of resisting those forces that were calling for an embargo. He clearly understood. His top foreign policy advisor, Sumner Wells, also made it clear in early July that he thought an embargo would lead directly to war for the reasons that we're talking about. Okay? Well, what about the other argument, the loss of control argument, the Utley argument? It turns out that policy had not been hijacked. You know, if it were the case that, you know, these second-tier officials could overrule the political leadership and shape policy on their own, that would be a very important and, in fact, disturbing conclusion if you believe that America's a democracy and the political leader should basically shape policy. But it turns out not to be true, right? The key evidence was presented by a scholar named Waldo Heinrichs in a book called Threshold of War. And it's kind of buried in the back of the book. If you weren't interested in these issues, you would probably even miss it. And Heinrichs showed that, contrary to what people like Utley had argued, Roosevelt himself was pulling the strings. Acheson was taking his orders from Undersecretary of State Wells, who was very close to Roosevelt in this period. And we know also from British sources that, from the records of the Argentia meeting, that Roosevelt and Wells were behind the policy, that they totally understood what was going on. Okay? So neither of those arguments, neither the ignorance argument nor the loss of control argument, is borne out by a study of the evidence. Now, what does that mean? It means that the policy has to be viewed as deliberate. Roosevelt knew what he was doing. He was controlling policy, fully aware of what the implications were. So how's that to be understood? He deliberately put the United States on a collision course with Japan. How is that to be understood? Well, to answer that question, you have to go back and give some attention to Roosevelt's basic strategic thinking. He wanted to take the United States into the war against Germany. Hitler was making this very difficult for Roosevelt. He wanted to take the United States into the war. He understood how important it was to take the United States into the war relatively quickly. He bought the whole argument of the victory program. And yet he differed from his military leadership on the whole issue of whether a bellicose policy vis-a-vis Japan made sense. So you look at all this stuff and you say, something must have come into play to tip the balance for Roosevelt in the opposite direction. He agreed with the military about all this stuff, but disagreed with them about Japan. What was that something that came into play? It had to be something. Why he didn't go along with them in that argument, although he shared so many of their premises, the answer there was he had a very good sense for the domestic political context within which he had to work. And that if he was frustrated in terms of his preferred policy, which is provoking Hitler to declare war on the United States, he could go to war through the back door, through provoking Japan. Right? That's somewhat speculative, but it strikes me that that's the most plausible interpretation of all these events. A very important conclusion. Because it affects the entire way you understand American involvement in the war and the role that geostrategic considerations play in shaping policy. Yeah? Roosevelt knew what he was doing. He pursued this policy vis-a-vis Japan as a way of taking the United States into the war. Now, if true, what does this mean? Well, it tells us something fundamental about the American political system. If that was the policy Roosevelt pursued, should you condemn him for it? Well, I, for one, wouldn't. But what it means is that he was forced to operate in a political system that constrained his freedom of action and prevented him from pursuing the policy that made most sense in geostrategic terms. In other words, taking on the Germans and not dealing with the Japanese, because the U.S. people wouldn't go to war for that reason. They only like to go to war if they themselves are attacked. And so this creates an enormous incentive for the political leadership to stage manage things so that, as far as the Greek public is concerned, the United States appears as the innocent victim of unprovoked attack. Right? That's a conclusion which has, I think, very far-reaching implications. Anyway, I'm out of time here. Let me end there. Next time I'm going to give a lecture kind of reviewing all the stuff we've covered in class so far to help you prepare for the midterm on Monday.